That. I was calm. Not normal calm, but the cool, distant calm that you either learn to do during the really bad stuff, or you run screaming. I'd done all the screaming I planned on doing tonight. Her life did not matter. Yours does. I'm glad to be alive, and don't take this wrong, but why do you give a damn if I live or die?
We need you,
a male voice said from behind me. I had to arch my neck and crane my head backward to see the owner of that second voice. I didn't see the man at first because he was surrounded by the flayed ones. I'd known that Edward was worried that they'd missed some bodies. He had no idea. There must have been 25, 35 animated corpses standing behind me. They'd been standing so quietly, I hadn't heard them or sensed them. They stood there now like robots with the switch turned off, waiting for life to return. Zombies never got that still, never went that empty. At the end, when they started to rot and you had to put them back in the grave before they melted into little puddles, they were more alive than this. I realized in that instant that the bodies were raised, but the person inside that body wasn't raised. The master ate that which made them individuals. He ate that which made them more than so much muscle and skin. He didn't eat the souls, because I'd seen one of them in a house where two flayed ones had been made. But he took something out of their bodies, some memory or remnant that I left in when I raised the dead. They stood like rocks carved of flesh, utterly empty. At least the ones in the hospital had pretended to still be alive. There was no pretense here. My eyes finally found the man. He wore a steel helmet and breastplate like the history books are always showing the conquistadors wearing, but the rest of the outfit was straight out of a nightmare. He wore a necklace of tongues, and they were all still fresh and pink as if they'd just been cut out seconds ago. He wore a skirt of intestines that writhed and twisted like snakes, as if each thick glistening strand had an independent life of its own. His arms were bare, strong and muscled, and covered in the missing eyelids of the victims. As he moved close, the eyelids opened and closed. He came to stand beside me, next to the first man. The eyelids blinked at me, and there were eye-shaped holes underneath every lid that I saw. The holes held darkness and the cold light of stars. I turned away because I was remembering Itz Papalotl's starry eyes. I didn't want to fall into these eyes. At that second, if you had given me a choice, I'd have taken the vampire in town to the thing that was standing in front of me. After what I'd seen at the murder scene, I expected to feel evil emanating from him, but there was no evil. There was power like being next to a battery the size of the Chrysler Building. The energy hummed along my skin, but it was neutral energy. Neither good nor bad in and of itself, the way a gun is neither good nor bad, but can be turned to evil purposes. I stared up the line of his body, and the tongues were moving as if still trying to scream. He took off the helmet and showed a slender, handsome face that reminded me of Bernardo's, not the pure Aztec ethnicity I'd been expecting. He had turquoise ear spools in his lobes, and they matched the blue-green of his eyes. He smiled down at me, looking like a fresh-faced 20-something. I could feel the weight of the ages in his gaze like some vast weight pressing down on me, as if just being this close made it hard to breathe. He reached out to touch my face, and I jerked back from him. That one movement seemed to break his hold over me. I could move. I could breathe. I could think. I'd been on the receiving end of enough magical glamour to know it when I felt it. You're either a god, or you're not. He was not. And it wasn't just my monotheism showing. I'd felt the magic of monsters and preternatural beasties of all sorts, and I knew one when I saw one. Power doesn't make you a deity. I don't know exactly what does, but power ain't it. Some spark of the divine was missing from the being that gazed down upon me. If he was just another monster, maybe we could deal. Who are you? And I was happy that my voice was confident, normal.
I am the Red Woman's husband.
He gazed down at me with eyes so patient, so kind. You think angels must have eyes like that. The Red Woman is the Aztec phrase for blood. What does it mean that you're blood's husband?
I am the body, and she is the life.
He said it like it answered my question. It didn't. Something wet and slimy touched my hand. I jerked back, but the chain didn't let me go far. The length of animated intestine followed my hand, nuzzling it like some obscene worm. I swallowed a scream, but I couldn't keep my pulse from speeding up. He laughed at me. It was a very ordinary laugh for a would-be god, but it was nicely condescending, and maybe that's how would-be gods laughed. But it was a peculiarly masculine condescension, long gone out of style. The laugh says, "Silly little girl, don't you know I'm the big strong man and you know nothing and I know everything?" Or maybe I'm just too sensitive. "Why intestines?" I asked. The smile faded around the edges. His handsome face looked puzzled.
"Are you making fun of me?"
The intestine dropped away from my hand like a date that I'd rebuffed.
"Fine with me."
"No. I just wondered why intestines. You can obviously animate any body part. You can keep detached parts from decaying like the skins your men are wearing. With all that to choose from, why people's guts and not something else? People love to talk about themselves. The bigger the ego, the more they enjoy it. I was hoping that the red woman's husband was the same as everyone else, at least in this one thing.
"I wear the roots of their bodies, so that all that see me will know that my enemies are empty shells, and I have all that was theirs."
"Ask a silly question."
"Why the tongues?"
"So that the lies of my enemies will not be believed."
"Eyelids?"
"I will open the eyes of my enemies so that they may never again close their eyes to the truth."
He was answering questions so nicely that I decided to try for more. "How did you skin the people without using a tool of some kind?"
"Tlaloki, my priest, called the skin from their bodies."
"How?" I asked.
"My power," he said.
"Don't you mean Tlaloki's power?" He frowned again.
"All his power derives from me."
"Sure," I said.
"I am his master. He owes all to me."
"Sounds like you owe him."
"You do not know what you are saying."
He was getting angry. Probably not what I wanted. I tried another more polite question. "Why take the breasts and penises?"
"To feed my minion."
He did nothing, but suddenly I felt the air in the cavern move, and it was as if the shadows themselves drew apart like a curtain revealing a tunnel about 30 feet from the foot of where I lay. Something crawled out of that tunnel. The first impression was of a brilliant iridescent green. The scales changed color at every turn of the light. First green, then blue and green all at once, then a pearl-white glitter that I thought I must have imagined, until it turned its head and flashed a white underbelly. The green scales went closer to true blue as the color moved up towards the head until the square snout was a clear, pure blue, the color of sky. There was a fringe of delicate feathers and a rainbow of colors around that face. It turned and stared at me, fanning the feathers around its scaled head into a display that would have been the envy of any peacock. Its eyes were round and huge, taking up most of its face like the eyes of a bird of prey. A pair of slender wings was folded along its back, rainbow colors of the fringe, but I knew without seeing that the underside of the wings would be white. It pushed forward on four legs. Counting the wings, it was a six-limbed animal. It was a Quetzalcoatl Draconis Giganticus, or at least that was the last Latin classification I was aware of. Sometimes they were classed as a subspecies of dragon, sometimes as a subspecies of gargoyles, and sometimes they had their own group all to themselves. Whatever classification, the Giganticus was the biggest and supposedly extinct. The Spaniards had killed a lot of them to dishearten the natives to whom they were sacred, and because it was just the European thing to do. See a dragon? Kill it. It was not a complex philosophy. I'd only seen black and white photos, and the stuffed one in the Chicago Field Museum. The photos hadn't come close to doing it justice. And the stuffed one? Well, maybe it was a bad taxidermy job. It glided into the room in a shimmering roll of color and muscle. It was literally one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. It was also probably what had been gutting people. It opened that sky-blue snout and yawned, showing rows of saw-like teeth. The sound of its claws clattered over the stone floor like some nightmarish dog. Red Woman's husband laid his Spanish helmet on the stone by my legs and went to greet the creature. It lowered its head to be petted, very like a dog. He stroked it just above the eye ridges and it made a low, rolling sound, eyes closing to slits. It was purring. He sent it away with a playful push against one muscular shoulder. I watched it vanish back through the tunnel like it wasn't real. I thought they were extinct.
"My minion helped bring us to this place. Then it slept a magic sleep, waiting for me to awake. I didn't know Quetzalcoatls could hibernate."
He frowned at me again and came to stand by my head.
I know what your word hibernate means, but it was a magic sleep, done by the last of my warrior priests. The priest sacrificed himself, putting all of us in an enchanted sleep, knowing that there was no one to aid him, and that he would die alone in this alien place long before I rose.
Enchanted sleep. Sounded like Sleeping Beauty. That's true loyalty. Sacrifice yourself for the better good.
I'm so glad you agree. It will make what has to happen much easier.
Didn't like the sound of that. Maybe flattery wasn't the way to go. I'd try something more normal for me. Sarcasm, and see if that led us away from the topic of my impending doom. I don't owe you any loyalty. I am not one of your followers.
Only because you do not understand,
he said, and those smiling eyes gazed down at me with a look of almost perfect peace. That's what Jim Jones said just before he gave everyone the Kool-Aid.
I do not know this name, Jim Jones.
Then he turned his head to one side, and it reminded me of Itz Papalotto when she listened to voices I could not hear. Now I realize that it might just be a way to access other people's memories.
Ah, I know who he is now.
He looked down at me with those calm, beatific eyes.
But I am no madman. I am a god.
He was getting distracted, as if it mattered to him for me to believe he was a god. If he had to convince me that he was divine before he killed me, then I was safe. He could kill me, but he'd never convince me he was a god. He frowned.
You do not believe me.
He sounded surprised again, and I realized that for all his power, he seemed young. The ages raged through the eyes on his arms as though you could see back through to the beginning of creation, but he himself seemed young. Or maybe he just wasn't used to people who didn't drop down and worship him. If that's all you'd known in your entire existence, then anyone not worshipping you might be a shock.
I am a god,
he repeated, and his voice had that condescending tone again. Whatever you say. But I made sure my doubt showed in my voice. The frown deepened, and again I was reminded forcibly of a pouting child. A spoiled, pouting child.
You must believe that I am a god. I am the Red Woman's husband. I am the body that will be revenged on those that destroyed my people.
You mean the Spanish conquistadors?
Yes, he said.
There aren't a lot of conquistadors in New Mexico, I said.
Their blood still runs in the veins of their children's children's children.
No offense, but you didn't get those turquoise blue eyes from anyone local. He frowned again, and little lines formed between his eyes. If he kept talking to me, he was going to get frown lines.
I am a god created by my people's tears. I am the power that is left of the Aztecs, and I am the Spaniards' magic made flesh. We will use their own power to destroy them.
Isn't it a little late to destroy them? About 500 years too late.
Gods do not reckon time as men do.
I believed that he believed what he was saying, but I also thought he was rationalizing. He'd have kicked the Spaniards' butt 500 years ago if he'd been able to do it. Maybe it showed on my face because he said,
I was a new god then, and I did not have the strength to defeat our enemies. So the Quetzalcoatl brought me here to wait until I grew strong enough for our purpose. I am ready to lead my army forward now.
So you're saying that it took 500 years for you to go from being a wee little god to a big bad god, the way soup needs to simmer for a really long time before it's soup? He laughed.
You think very strangely. I am sad that you will be dead soon. I would make you the first of my concubines, and the mother of gods, for children born of you would be great sorcerers, but sadly, I have need of your life.
We were back to killing me, and I didn't want to be there. His ego seemed pretty fragile for a deity. I'd see how fragile. The offer doesn't sound very appealing. No offense. He smiled down at me, fingers trailing along my arm.
That we will take your life is not an offer. It is a fact.
I gave him my best innocent eyes. I thought you were offering to make me your concubine, the mother of gods. He frowned at me harder.
I did not offer you a chance to be my concubine.
Oh, I said. Sorry, I misunderstood you. His fingers were still touching my arm, but they were still now, as if he'd forgotten he was touching me.
You would refuse my bed?
He sounded truly perplexed. Great. Yeah, I said.
Is it your virtue you are protecting?
No, it's just your particular offer doesn't appeal to me. He was really having trouble with the concept that I didn't find him attractive. He ran his fingers down my bare arm in a tickling brush. I just lay there and looked at him. I was giving him some of the best eye contact I'd given anyone this trip because if I looked anywhere else, I kept seeing severed body parts wiggling on their own. Hard to be tough as nails when you wanted to start screaming. He touched my face, and I let him this time. His fingers traced my face, delicately, gently. His eyes no longer looked peaceful. No, definitely disturbed. He leaned into me as if he'd kiss me, and the eyelashes on his arms fluttered in butterfly kisses along my body. I gave a little shriek. He drew back.
What is wrong?
Oh, I don't know. Severed eyelids fluttering against my skin, intestines that writhe like snakes around your waist, the necklace of tongues trying to lick me. Pick one.
But that should not matter, he said. You should see me as beautiful, desirable.
I did the best shrug I could with my hands chained higher than my shoulders. Sorry, but I just can't get past what you're wearing.
Tleloki, he said.
The man in shorts came forward and dropped to one knee before him.
Yes, my lord. Why does she not see me as wonderful? Apparently the aura of your godhood does not work on her.
Why not? And there was anger now in his voice, in that once peaceful face.
I do not know, my lord. You said she could replace Nikki Bako. You said she was a Nahuli as he was. You said she had been touched by my magic, and it was the scent of my magic that drew the Quetzalcoatl to her. But she lies under the touch of my hands and does not feel for me. That is not possible if my magic clings to her.
I thought, what if it's not his magic? But I didn't say it out loud. What if it was Itzpapalotl's? The being standing in front of me had nearly killed me from a distance. He'd roared over my mind and taken me, and I hadn't been able to stop him. Now, he was touching me and evidently trying things on me, and it wasn't working. The only thing that had changed was Itzpapalotl's power filling me for a while. Had that made the difference? Tleloki stood, head still bowed.
There must be powerful magic at work here, my lord. First Nikki Bako is lost to us, and now this one is closed to your vision.
She must be open to my power, or she cannot be the perfect sacrifice, Red Woman's husband said.
I know, my lord.
You are the magician, Tleloki. How can I undo this magic?
The magician put some serious thought into it. Several minutes passed while he thought. I just lay there trying not to draw their attention back to me. Finally, Tleloki looked up.
To believe in your vision, she must believe in you.
How do I convince her to believe that I am a god if she cannot feel my power?
It was a good question, and I waited patiently for Tleloki to answer it. The longer he thought about it, the more delay time I was getting.
Ramirez was coming. I had to believe that because my options were limited unless I could figure out a way to get them to untie me. I could feel the pen still in my pocket with its hidden blade. I was armed if I could get my hands free, and if steel could hurt him. Of course, there were the four helpers, and Tleloki, and a small army of flayed ones. So even if the god could die, I'd have to do something about everyone else. They'd probably be pissed if I killed their god. I just wasn't sure how to get out of this one. If Ramirez didn't arrive with the cavalry, I was in deep shit. Edward wasn't out there looking for me this time. For the first time since I came to, I wondered if Edward was alive. Please, God, let him be alive. But alive or not, Edward was out of the rescuing game for tonight. I admitted I needed help on this one, and the only hope I could count on was Ramirez and the police. He'd been late in the hospital. If he were late tonight, I probably wouldn't be around to complain. Tleloki motioned for his god to follow him a little away from me. I think they were whispering things they didn't want me to know. Why did it matter if I overheard them or not? What could they possibly be talking about that they needed to hide from me? They'd cheerfully told me they were going to kill me. It wasn't like they were trying to protect my feelings. So what was going on? The Red Woman's husband unfastened the necklace of tongues and handed it to the priest. He took off the steel breastplate, and one of the skin guys came and took it from him, kneeling in front of him. He took off the skirt of intestines, and another skin guy hurried forward to take it. The god never asked them to help him, just sort of assumed that someone would be there to help. He was almost perfectly arrogant, but his ego was fragile, an arrogance that had never been tested in the outer world.
He was like one of those fairy tale princesses that had been raised in an ivory tower, with only people who told them how beautiful they were, how smart, how good, until the witch comes and lays her curse. Maybe I could be the witch, though truthfully I wouldn't have known a curse if it bit me on the butt. Maybe I could be the prince that comes and takes him away. At this point, I wasn't picky. The god was wearing a maxillotl like everyone at the Obsidian Butterfly had worn. But this one was black with a heavy fringe of golden thread hanging in front. He wore black sandals set with turquoise, which strangely I hadn't noticed when he was wearing all the severed body parts. Funny how you don't concentrate on the small details when you're scared. He walked towards me, confidence showing in every step. The maxillotl left his lower body bare on the sides from waist to sandals. It was a nice length of thigh, but you know what they say. Pretty is as pretty does.
"Is this better?"
he asked, his voice light, almost teasing, his eyes back to that peaceful contentment, as if things had always gone his way, and he didn't see why now should be different. Eats Papalotl had been arrogant, but not peaceful. "Much better," I said. I thought about remarking on how much I liked seeing nearly naked men, but didn't want to take it to such an obviously sexual tone unless I ran out of other options. He came to stand beside me again. The eyelids were still on his arms, blinking at me like the winking lights of fireflies, random and alien. "It's a big improvement," I said. "You can't do anything about the eyes on your arms, can you?" He frowned again.
"They are part of me."
"I see that," I said.
"But they are nothing to fear."
"If you say so."
"I want you to know me, Anita."
It was the first time he'd used my name. I hadn't thought he knew it until then. Of course, Paulina had known who I was. The Red Woman's husband reached down to my right wrist, and he undid that little piece of metal that held the manacle closed. The skinned man who was still standing on the other side of the stone took a step forward, hand on the knife at his belt. I froze, not sure if I was really going to be allowed to have my hand free. The god lifted my hand free of the chain and laid his lips on the back of my hand.
"Touch them. See that they are nothing to fear."
It took me a second to figure out that "them" meant the eyes on his arms. I was relieved to realize he didn't mean anything below his waist, and so not happy that he meant all those eyes. I did not want to touch them. I wanted nothing to do with anything that had been carved off of a dead body, especially while that person had still been alive. He held my wrist and tried to bring my hand over his arm, but I kept a tight fist.
"Touch them, Anita, gently. They will not harm you."
He began to pry my fingers open, and I couldn't fight him. I could have fought harder, maybe make him break a finger or two to persuade me. But in the end, I was going to lose this wrestling match, so I just let him spread my hand open. I didn't want anything broken if I could avoid it. He guided my hand just above his arm, and the eyelids fluttered under my touch. I jumped every time one of them blinked, but the eyelids moving against my skin in a line of butterfly kisses weren't as scary. The lids felt full, as if there was an eye behind them, and there wasn't. I'd seen that.
"What's inside them?" I asked.
"Everything," he said,
which told me nothing.
"Explore them, Anita."
He pressed one of my fingertips to the edge of an eye. Then he urged me to put the finger inside the eye. I pushed my finger into that empty-seeming eye, and there was a resistance like pushing against something thin and fleshy. Then my finger was through, and I could touch what was inside.
Warm.
A warmth that flowed through my hand, up my arm, and spread like a blanket over my body. I felt safe. Warm. I stared up at him and wondered why I hadn't seen it before. He was so handsome. So kind. So... My finger was cold. So cold that it hurt. It had that stinging pain that you get just before you lose all feeling in the limb, and frostbite settles in and spills over your body, and you fall into that last gentle sleep never to wake. I jerked my hand back and blinked awake, with a gasp.
"What is wrong?"
he asked, and leaned over me, touching my face. I jerked away from him, cradling my hand against my chest, staring up at him, afraid.
"You're cold inside."
He took a step back from me, and the surprise showed on his face.
"You should feel safe. Warm."
He leaned over me, trying to get me to gaze into his blue-green eyes. I shook my head. Feeling was coming back into my finger in a stinging rush, the way circulation comes back after frostbite. The throbbing ache helped me think, helped me avoid his gaze. "I'm not safe," I said, and I'm not warm. I looked away from him, which put me gazing at the skin-clad guy. But truthfully, even that was better than staring at the god. Eats Papalotto's touch was helping me, but it had limits. If I fell into his eyes, wherever they might be, they'd just kill me, and I might go willingly, eagerly into that last dark.
You are making this difficult, Anita.
I kept my gaze on the far wall. Sorry that I'm ruining your night. He stroked the curve of my face. I flinched as if he'd hurt me. I'd thought what I was trying to delay was my death. Now I realized that I was trying to delay falling into his power. They'd kill me after that, but I'd be gone before the knife fell. Had Paulina gone like that, willingly, eager to please the god? I hoped so for her sake. For mine, I wasn't so sure.
I want you to believe that your death will be for a great purpose.
Sorry, not buying swampland today. I could almost feel his puzzlement like a play of energy along my skin. I'd felt anger, lust, fear dance along my skin from vampires and were-animals, but I'd never felt puzzlement before. I hadn't felt his emotions before I touched that damned eye. He was sucking me down a piece at a time. He grabbed my hand. No! I said it through gritted teeth. He could break my fingers this time, but I wasn't just opening up and touching him again. I couldn't just cooperate with him anymore, not even to buy time. I had to start fighting him now, or there'd be nothing left of me. I'd had vampires roll my mind before, but I'd never felt anything like him. Once he got a really good hold on my mind, I wasn't 100% sure I'd come back. There are a lot of ways to die. Being killed is only one of the more obvious ones. If he rolled my mind and there was nothing left of who I was, then I was dead, or would wish I was. I flexed my arm, hugging it to my chest, straining my muscles to keep it there. He lifted the wrist and my whole upper body with it, but I held the arm, fingers closed into a fist.
Do not make me hurt you, Anita.
I'm not making you do anything. Whatever you do, it's your choice to do it, not mine. He laid me back down gently.
I could crush your hand.
It sounded like a threat, but his voice was still gentle. I won't touch you again, not like that, not voluntarily.
But lay your hand upon my chest above my heart. That is not a hard thing, Anita.
No.
You are a very stubborn woman.
You're not the first one to say it, I said.
I will not force you.
The skinned man moved forward until he was directly against the stone, mirroring his god. He drew an obsidian blade and bent over me. I tensed, but I didn't say anything. I could not touch him again, and promise I'd come out the other side. If I was going to die anyway, I'd die whole, not possessed by some would-be god. But he didn't stab me. He slipped the tip of the blade under the shoulder of the Kevlar vest. Kevlar isn't meant to stop a stabbing motion, but it's not an easy thing to cut through, especially with a stone knife. The empty skin hand that decorated his wrist wobbled back and forth as he sawed. I stared past him at the far wall, but my peripheral vision just couldn't get rid of that flopping hand. I finally had to stare up at the ceiling, but it was just darkness. It's hard to stare into the dark when there are other things to look at, but I tried. I almost asked them if they knew what Velcro was, but didn't. It would take them a while to cut the vest off with an obsidian blade. Hell, I might not have to do anything else to delay them. It'd be morning by the time the obsidian cut through the material. Unfortunately, I wasn't the only one who figured that out. The skin man put the blade back in his sheath and pulled a second knife out from a sheath behind his back, the way you'd carry a backup gun. When he raised it into the firelight, it glimmered silver, steel. With or without high silver content, it would still cut through the vest a lot quicker than the obsidian. He slipped the tip under the shoulder seam of the vest. I finally had to say something. You just planning to cut my heart out?
Your heart will remain in your chest where it belongs, the god said.
Then why do you want the vest off? I finally turned my head and looked at him, though not at any of his eyes.
If you will not touch my chest with your hand, there are other parts of your body that can feel, he said.
It was almost enough to make me give him my hand. Almost. I didn't trust what he might consider other parts of my body that could feel. But it would take time to get the vest off, and if I just gave up my hand, that wouldn't take any time at all. I needed the time. The vest came off quicker than you'd think. It was not designed to stand up to a sawing blade. They pulled the pieces of the vest off me, tugging the last from under my back. The Red Woman's husband climbed up beside me. He knelt, staring down at me, and he wasn't staring at my face. He traced the outline of my bra with the tip of one finger, trailing oh so lightly along my skin.
What is this?
He traced under the bra back and forth, back and forth. Underwire, I said. He traced the black lace at the top of the bra.
So many new things to learn.
Glad you like it, I said. He didn't get the sarcasm. Maybe he was immune to it. He did what I'd thought he'd do. He climbed on top of me. But he didn't get into a standard missionary position. He scooted lower until his chest was pressed against mine. With our height differences, that put his groin safely below mine. So it wasn't rape that we were doing. Maybe it was just me that worried so much about that. But somehow the knowledge that it wasn't sex he was after scared me more. There were worse things he could take from me than sex, like my mind. His chest pressed against mine, smooth, warm, very human. Nothing bad happened. Funny, that didn't slow the frantic beat of my heart or make me look him in the eyes.
Do you feel it?
He asked. I just kept staring at the far wall of the cave. I don't know what you mean. His chest pressed harder against me.
Do you feel my heart beating?
It wasn't the question I'd been expecting, so I actually thought about it. I tried to feel the answering beat of his heart against me, but all I could feel was my own panicked pulse. Sorry. All I can feel is mine.
And that is the problem, he said.
I actually looked up at him then, getting a brief glimpse of his face, leaning so close below mine, the startling glimpse of his blue-green eyes in that dark face. I looked back to the wall.
What do you mean? My heart does not beat.
I tried to feel his heart then, tried to sense the pulse of life through the warm flesh of his chest. Concentrating on it slowed my own heart. You aren't always aware of a man's heart beating against your body, but when they're lying chest to chest, you usually feel it. But his chest pressed quiet above mine. I moved my free hand slowly toward him. He raised up, supporting himself with his hands, so I could press my hand against his chest. His skin was warm and smooth, almost perfect, but nothing beat under my hand. Either he had no heart, or it wasn't beating.
I am only a body. The Red Woman does not live in me. My heart is not a fit sacrifice without her touch.
That made me look back at him. I looked into his peaceful eyes. Sacrifice? You're going to sacrifice yourself? His eyes stayed gentle and hopeful.
I will be a sacrifice to the Creator Gods. They need to feed on the blood of a god as they did at the beginning of time.
I tried to read something in that peaceful, handsome face. Some doubt, fear, anything I could understand. You're going to let your priest cut you up?
Yes, but I will be reborn.
You're sure of that? I said.
My heart will be strong enough to beat outside my body, and when it is placed back within me, the old gods will return from the exile that your white Christ has cast them into.
His face, more than his words, said that he did believe it. I'd read enough of the conquest of Mexico by the Spanish to doubt that Christ had much to do with it, no matter how many things had been done in his name. Don't blame Jesus Christ for what the Spanish did to your people. Our God gave us free choice, and that means we can choose evil. I believe that that's what happened to the men who conquered your people. He looked down at me and he was puzzled again.
You believe that? I can tell you believe that.
With all my heart, I said. No pun intended. He sat up, sitting across my waist.
Most of the people I have taken as offerings did not believe in much of anything. The ones who did not believe in your white Christ.
He touched my face.
But you do.
Yeah, I said.
How can you believe in a god that would allow you to be brought to this place and sacrificed to a foreign god?
If you only believe when it's easy, you don't really believe, I said.
It is not ironic that you, a follower of the god that destroyed us, will be what allows me to come into my power. When I have taken your essence, I will be strong enough to make the precious liquid, and I will be free of this place at last.
What do you mean, take my essence? I'd stop being afraid because we'd just been talking so long. Or maybe I just can't sustain fear for that long. Eventually, if you don't kill me or hurt me, I stop being afraid.
I will but kiss you, and you will become as light and dry as the aged maize. You will feed me as the corn feeds men.
He began to lie down beside me on my right side, near my free hand. I was suddenly scared again. I hoped I was wrong, but but I was pretty sure I'd already seen what he meant to do to me at the obsidian butterfly.
You mean you'll suck the life out of me, and I'll end up looking like a dried mummy.
He stroked a finger down my cheek, his eyes sad now, regretful.
It will hurt a great deal, and I am sorry for that, but even your pain will go to strengthen me.
He leaned his face towards mine. I had a free hand and a knife in my pocket, but if I went for it too soon and failed, I was out of options. Where the hell was Ramirez? You're going to torture me.
Great, I said.
He drew back from me just a little.
It is not torture. It is the way all my priests waited for my waking.
Who brought your priest back? I asked.
I wakened Teleloki, but I was weak and I had no more blood to give the others. Then before we could raise the others, the man you call Riker disturbed our place of rest.
He stared off into space, as if he were seeing it over again.
He found what you called the mummies of my priests. Many were torn apart by his men, searching for jewels inside them.
Anger darkened his face, stole the peacefulness from his eyes.
The Quetzalcoatl was not yet awake, or we would have killed them all. They took things that belonged to my priests. It forced me to find a different way to give them back their lives.
The skins, I said. He looked down at me.
Yes, there are ways to make them give life.
So you hunted down the people who desecrated your sleeping place, and the people who bought the things that belonged to your people?
Yes, he said.
I guess from a certain point of view it was fair. If you had no ability to feel mercy, then it was a dandy plan. You killed and took the organs from the people who were gifted, I said.
Gifted?
He made it a question. Witches, brujos.
Ah, yes. I did not wish to leave them alive to hunt us before I came into my power.
He was touching my face again, stroking it. I think he was getting back on track to give me his kiss. What exactly does coming into your power mean? I asked. As long as I could keep him talking, he wouldn't be killing me. I could think of questions all night long.
I will be mortal and immortal.
I widened eyes at him. What do you mean mortal?
Your blood will make me mortal. Your essence will make me immortal.
I frowned at him.
I don't understand what you mean.
He cupped my face in his hands like a lover.
How could you possibly understand the ways of gods?
He held out his hand, and the skin man handed him a long bone needle.
Maybe I didn't know what he was going to do.
What's that for? He held the needle, maybe 4 inches long, twirling it slowly between his fingers.
I will pierce your earlobe and drink your blood. It will be a small pain.
You keep saying you want me to believe in you, but you're the only one who never seems to be in pain. Your priests, the people who stole from you, all the sacrifices, everybody hurts but you. He propped himself up on one elbow, his body snug against mine.
If my pain will convince you of my sincerity, then so be it.
He jabbed the needle into his finger, deep enough to touch bone. He drew the needle out slowly, making it hurt as much as he could. I waited for blood to come to the surface, but it didn't. He held the finger so I could see the hole the needle had left, but the hole was empty, no blood. As I watched, the wound closed like water smoothing, perfect once more. The knife wasn't going to do me any good, not against him.
Does my pain make your pain less? He asked.
I'll let you know, I said. He smiled, so patient, so kind, so full of it. He started moving the needle towards my left ear. I could have fought him with my free hand, but if all he was going to do was pierce my earlobe like I'd seen at the nightclub, then he could do that. I didn't like the idea, but I wasn't going to fight him. If I fought now, they might chain my hand back up. I wanted the free hand more than I wanted to keep him from sucking on my ear. Truth is, I don't like needles. Not just doctor needles, any of them. I have a phobia about small pointed things in my body. Knives don't seem to bother me, but needles do. Go figure. It was a phobia. To keep from struggling, I finally had to close my eyes because otherwise I'd have fought. I just couldn't help it. The pain was sharp and immediate. I gasped, opening my eyes, watching his face lean over me. For a second I thought I'd blown it. I thought he was going straight to the kiss. Then his mouth passed by my mouth. He turned my face to the right, gently, exposing the ear and the long line of my neck. It reminded me of vampires, except that this mouth licked my ear, one quick movement. He made a small sigh as he swallowed the first blood, Then his mouth closed over my earlobe, mouth working at the wound, tongue coaxing blood from the wound. He pressed his body the length of mine, one hand cupping my turned head, the other playing down the line of my body. Maybe it was just blood, but I never stroked my steak while I was eating it. The line of his jaw was pressed to my face. I could feel his mouth moving as he swallowed. I'd had vampires take blood without me being under their spell, so it had hurt. This didn't hurt nearly as much. It was more like an overzealous lover with an ear fetish. Disturbing, but not really painful. His hand moved from my face to slide inside my bra. That I didn't like. I thought you said you weren't offering sex. He drew his hand out of my bra and drew back from my ear. His eyes were wide and unfocused and drowning in turquoise glow like the eyes of any vampire when its bloodlust is up. "Forgive me," he said, "but it has been so very long since I felt life in my body." I thought I understood what he meant, but I was asking every question I could think of tonight. Anything to keep him talking. "What do you mean?" He laughed and rolled on his side to prop himself up on his elbow again. He jabbed the needle into his finger again and gasped. Blood welled up from the wound, crimson blood. He laughed again. "Your blood runs through my body, and I am mortal once more, with all the appetites of a mortal man." "You need blood to have blood pressure," I said. "You've got your first hard-on in centuries. I get it." He looked down at me with drowning eyes.
"You could have it."
He moved so that his body was pressed against mine, and I could feel him pressed against my jeans, eager and ready. I started to say my usual no, then stopped. If my choices were being raped or being killed when I thought that help was on the way, I debated, and I really don't know what I would have said, because another of the skin men ran in from behind us where the silent flayed ones waited. I heard the man's running footsteps and turned to watch him push his way through the flayed ones. He dropped to one knee in front of the red woman's husband.
"My lord, armed strangers are approaching. The little brujo is with them, leading them this way."
The red woman's husband looked at him.
"Kill them. Delay them. When I have come into my power, it will be too late."
The skin men got weapons out of a chest and went running. I turned my head to watch the flayed ones trail after them. Only Talalaki the priest stayed behind. It was just the three of us. Ramirez was coming. The police were coming. Surely I could delay a few more minutes. Fingers touched my face, moving me to look at him.
"You could have been the first woman in centuries for me, but there is no time."
He began to lower his face towards me.
"I am sorry that I must take you as an unwilling sacrifice, because you have not harmed me or mine."
I slipped my hand into my pocket. Fingers closed on the pen. I turned my head to the side so he couldn't kiss me, but I was really looking to see where Telalaki was in the room. He'd moved back to the altar. He'd thrown Paulina's body off to one side like so much garbage. He was cleaning the altar, preparing, I think, for his god's death. The red woman's husband stroked my face, trying to turn me gently towards him. He whispered, breath warm against my face.
"I will wear your heart on the necklace of tongues, so that all my followers may remember your sacrifice for all eternity."
"How romantic," I said. I started easing the pen out of my pocket.
"Turn to me, Anita. Do not make me hurt you."
His fingers closed on my chin and began to turn my face slowly towards his. I felt his strength in his fingers and knew he could crush my jaw with only a flexing of his hand. I couldn't keep him from turning my face up to him. I couldn't stop it, but I had the pen in my hand now. I had my finger on the button that would release the blade. I just had to make sure it was over his heart. Gunfire sounded from outside the cave, and it sounded close, as if the entrance wasn't that far away. Then there was a sound like a roaring, and I knew what it was because I'd heard it before. The police had brought flamethrowers or found some National Guard to join the party. I wondered whose idea it had been. It was a good one. I hope they all burned. I stared up at him, his fingers keeping my face looking at him.
"Does your heart really beat for me?" I asked. "My heart beats. Blood runs through this body. You have given me life, and now you will give me immortality."
The red woman's husband leaned over me like Prince Charming about to bestow the kiss that would make everything all right again. His mouth hovered an inch above mine. The memory of how Seth's body had died, was too vivid. I must have rushed to get the pen in position just above his heart. He pulled back a fraction of an inch, eyes questioning. I hit the button, and the blade took him through the heart. His eyes flew wide, all that turquoise fire fading, leaving his eyes human-looking.
What have you done?
You're just another kind of vampire. I kill vampires. He rolled off the stone, fell to the floor. He held a hand out to Telaloki. The priest rushed over to him. I didn't wait to see if there was a cure for the god. I undid my left wrist and reached down for my ankles. The red woman's husband collapsed to his knees, and the priest collapsed with him. He was crying.
No, no, no!
He pressed his hands around the hilt, trying to stop the blood from pouring out. His god fell into convulsions on the floor. He tried to hold his hands over the wound to staunch the blood. I got my ankles freed and rolled off to the other side of the stone. Call it a hunch, but I thought Telaloki would be upset with me. He rose to his feet, blood-stained hands held out in front of him. I'd never seen anyone look so horrified, so desolate, as if I had destroyed his world. And maybe I had. He never said a word, just drew the obsidian blade at his waist and stalked towards me. But the rock I'd been chained to was the size of a large dining room table, and I kept it between him and me. I kept the distance between us even, and he couldn't catch me. The gunfire was coming closer. He must have heard it too, because he suddenly rolled over the stone to slash at me with the knife. I ran away from the stone, out into the open, which was what he wanted. I turned and faced him. He came for me in a crouch, knife held loose but firm as if he knew what he was doing. I'd left the blade in the vampire. I faced him, hands out from my body, not sure what to do except not get cut. I thought of one thing. I screamed, Ramirez! Telaloki rushed me, blade slashing. I turned, feeling the rush of air as the blade passed. There were screams from the stairs, the sounds of in-close fighting. Telaloki slashed at me like a madman. All I could do was keep backing up, trying to stay out of reach. I was bleeding from both arms, and one cut in my upper chest, when I realized he'd backed me up by the altar. I tripped over Paulina's body about the second I started looking for it, to avoid it. I went down on my side, her body trapped under my legs. I kicked out at him without looking to see where he was, anything to keep him at a distance. He grabbed my ankle, pinning my leg against his body. We stared at each other, and I saw my death in his face. He tossed the knife one-handed so that the grip changed from slashing to a downward stab. He had my left leg pinned, but my right leg was still on the floor. I braced my upper body with my arms, leaned my shoulders downward, and drew back my right leg. I lined up his kneecap. Telaloki started the downward stroke. I kicked the downward edge of his kneecap with everything I had. I saw the kneecap slide sideways, dislocated. His leg crumbled. He cried out in pain, but the blade kept coming. Telaloki's head exploded in a shower of brains and bone. The pieces rained down on me, and the body fell to one side, obsidian blade scraping along the stone floor as the hand convulsed around the hilt. I stared across the cave and saw Olaf standing at the foot of the stone steps. He was still standing in his shooting stance, one-handed, gun still pointed at where the priest had been standing. He blinked, and I watched the concentration leave his face, watched something close to human spill across his face. He started walking towards me, gun at his side. The other hand held a knife, bloody to the hilt. I was wiping Telaloki's brains off my face when Olaf came to stand in front of me. I never thought I'd say this, but damn, I'm glad to see you. He actually smiled.
I saved your life.
That made me smile. I know. Ramirez came down the stairs with what looked like a SWAT team in full battle gear behind him. They spilled out to either side, nasty-looking guns pointed at every inch of the cavern. Ramirez just stood there, gun in hand, looking for something to shoot. National Guardsmen in flamethrower gear came next, nozzles of the flamethrowers pointed up at the ceiling. Olaf cleaned his knife on his pants, sheathed it, and offered me a hand. The hand was stained red, but I took it. His skin was sticky with blood, but I squeezed his hand and let him pull me to my feet. Bernardo came into the room with more cops behind him. His cast was red with blood, the blade sticking out of it so dark with blood it looked black. He said,
You're alive.
I nodded. Thanks to Olaf. He gave a small pressure to my hand, then let me go.
I was late again, Ramirez said.
I shook my head. Does it matter who saves the day as long as it gets saved? The other cops were starting to relax as they realized there was no one to shoot.
Is this all?
One of the black-decked cops asked. I looked back at the far tunnel. There's a Quetzalcoatl down that tunnel.
A what?
A dragon. Even through the battle gear, you could see them all exchange glances. Monster, if you like the word better, but it's still down there. They got into ranks and went past me to the tunnel at a crouched run. They hesitated at the tunnel entrance, then slipped through one at a time. For once, I let them go. I'd done my part for one night. Besides, they were a hell of a lot better armed than I was. One of them ordered Ramirez and some of the other more civvy-looking policemen to escort the civilians to the surface. Ramirez came to stand in front of me.
You're bleeding.
He touched the cut on my arm. I turned so he could see some of the other cuts. Pick one. Bernardo and the other cops that had been ordered to stay behind came to look at the two dead men.
Where's this red woman's husband that the little creep kept talking about? One of the cops asked.
I pointed at the body with the blade sticking out of its chest. Two of the cops went to stand over the body.
He doesn't look much like a god.
He was a vampire, I said. That got everyone's attention.
What did you say?
Ramirez asked. Let's concentrate on the important details here, boys. We need to make sure that body doesn't get back up. Trust me, he is one powerful son of a bitch. We want him to stay dead. A cop kicked the body, which rolled limply as only the true dead move.
Looks dead to me.
Watching the body roll limply made me jump, as if I expected him to sit up and say, "Just kidding, I'm not really dead." The body stayed still, but it hadn't done my nerves any good. We need to take the head and cut out his heart. Then we burn them separately and scatter the ashes over different bodies of water. Then we burn the body to ash and scatter it over a third body of water.
You've got to be kidding, one of the cops said.
The flayed ones just fell down and stopped moving, Ramirez said.
Did you do that?
Probably when I put the knife through his heart. Bullets hadn't worked on any of them until the flayed ones fell down. Then the bullets killed everything.
She did that?
The cop asked.
She made our bullets work?
Yes, Ramirez said, and probably he was right. Probably it had been me. Regardless, I wasn't going to raise any doubts. I wanted them to listen to me. I wanted to make sure that the god stayed dead.
How exactly do we chop off the head?
The same cop asked. Olaf went to the chest that the men had gotten their weapons out of and lifted a large, flat club with bits of obsidian embedded in it. He holstered his gun and walked to the body.
Shit, that's one of those damn things they used on us, the cop said. Nicely ironic to use it on their god, don't you think?
Bernardo asked. Olaf knelt beside the body.
Hey, we didn't say you could do that,
the cop said. Olaf looked at Ramirez.
What do you say, Ramirez?
I say we do whatever Anita says.
Olaf whirled the club as if getting the feel for it. It also made the cops back up. He looked at me.
I'll take the head.
I pulled the knife out of Tlaloki's hand. He wasn't going to be needing it anymore. I'll take the heart. I walked toward him, blade in hand. The cops kept backing away from us. I stood over the vampire. Olaf knelt on the other side, looking up at me.
If I'd let you get killed, Edward would have thought I failed.
Edward's alive, then?
Yes.
A tightness left my shoulders that I hadn't even realized was there.
Thank God.
I don't fail, Olaf said.
I believe you, I said. We stared at each other, and there was still something in his eyes that I couldn't read or understand, a step beyond whatever I'd become. I stared into his dark eyes and knew that here was a monster, not as powerful as the one that lay on the ground, but just as deadly in the right circumstances. And I owed him my life. You take the head first.
Why?
I'm afraid if I take the knife out while the body's still intact that he'll sit up and start breathing again. Olaf raised eyebrows at me.
You are not joking me?
I never joke about vampires, I said. He gave me another long look.
You would have made a good man.
I took the compliment because that's what it was. Maybe the best compliment he'd ever given a woman. Thank you, I said. The SWAT team came back out of the far tunnel.
There's nothing down there. It's empty.
Then it got away, I said. I looked at the body still lying there. Take the head. I want out of this damn cave. The SWAT team leader didn't like us cutting up the body. He and Ramirez went into a yelling match. While everyone was watching the argument, I nodded to Olaf and he beheaded the corpse in one blow. Blood gushed out onto the cave floor.
What the fuck are you doing?
One of the SWAT cops asked, bringing his gun pointed at us. My job, I said. I put the tip of the blade under the ribs. The policeman brought the gun up to his shoulder.
Get away from the body until the captain tells you it's okay to do it.
I kept the knife against the body. Olaf?
Yes?
If he shoots me, kill him.
My pleasure.
The big man turned his eyes to the policeman, and there was something in that gaze that made the heavily armed man take a step back. The captain in question said,
Stand down, Reynolds. She's a vamp executioner. Let her do her job.
I plunged the blade into the skin and it slid home. I cut a hole just below his ribs and reached into the hole. It was tight and wet and slick, and it took two hands to get the heart out, one to cut it free of the connecting tissue and one to hold onto it. I drew it from the chest, bloodstained to my elbows. I caught Ramirez and Bernardo both looking at me, with nearly identical looks on their faces. I didn't think either of them would be wanting a date anytime soon. They'd always remember watching me cut a man's heart out, and that memory would stain anything else. With Bernardo, I didn't give a shit. With Ramirez, it hurt to see that look in his eyes. A hand touched the heart. I stared at that hand, then looked up to meet Olaf's eyes. He wasn't repulsed. He stroked the heart, hands sliding over mine. I pulled away, and we looked at each other over the body we'd butchered. No, Olaf wasn't repulsed. The look in his eyes was that pure darkness that only fills a man's eyes in the most intimate of situations. He raised the severed head up by the hair and held it, almost as if he'd let me kiss it. Then I realized he was holding it over the heart, like a matched pair. I had to turn away from what I saw in his face. Does anyone have a bag that I can carry this in? Someone finally found an empty equipment bag and let me spill the heart into it. The policeman told me I could keep the bag. He didn't want it back. No one offered Olaf a bag, and he never asked.
Chapter 63. They found my guns in the chest with the rest of the weapons, though the holsters were missing. I just couldn't keep a holster intact on this job. But I stuffed the guns down my jeans. The knives weren't in the chest. Ramirez drove me personally to a crematorium so that I could see the heart and head burned down to ash. When I had two little containers of ash, it was almost dawn. I fell asleep in the seat beside him, or he'd have had a fight about taking me to the hospital. But he insisted that the doctors check me out. Amazingly enough, none of the cuts were even deep enough for stitches. I wouldn't even have any new scars. Miraculous. One of the men had given me a jacket that said FBI on it to cover my nearly naked upper body. Several of the uniforms and most of the hospital staff assumed I was a federal agent. I kept having to correct people, and I finally realized that the emergency room doctor thought my denial meant I had a concussion and didn't know who I was. The more I argued, the more concerned he got. He ordered a series of head x-rays, and I couldn't talk him out of it. I was actually sitting in a wheelchair waiting to be escorted to x-ray when Bernardo came up. He touched the FBI jacket.
You're moving up in the world.
When the nurse comes back, he'll be taking me down to x-ray.
You okay?
Just precautionary, I said.
I just came back from checking on the invalids.
Olaf said Edward would live.
He will.
How are the kids?
Peter is okay. They put Becca in a room. She's got a cast to her elbow.
I stared at his cast, stained a dirty brown. That thing is going to start stinking with all that blood dried into it.
The doc wants me to get a new cast, but I wanted to check on everyone first.
Where's Olaf? Bernardo shrugged.
I don't know. He disappeared once the monsters were all dead and Ramirez had you in his car. He said something about the job being done. I guess he went back under whatever rock Edward found him under.
I started to nod, then remembered something that Edward had said. Edward told you that you couldn't have a woman because he'd forbidden Olaf to have women, right?
Yeah, but the job's over, babe. I am headed for the first open bar.
I looked at him, nodding. Maybe that's where Olaf is. He frowned at me.
Olaf's at a bar?
No, he's out getting his ashes hauled his way. We both looked at each other, and there was a moment when horror dawned on Bernardo's face and he whispered,
Oh my God, he's out killing someone.
I shook my head. If he's just out killing at random, there's no way to find him. But what if it's not random?
What do you mean?
Remember how he looked at Professor Dallas? Bernardo looked at me.
You don't think, I mean, he wouldn't... Oh, shit.
I got up out of the wheelchair and said, I've got to tell Ramirez what we're thinking.
You don't know he's there. You don't know he's doing anything wrong.
Do you believe he just went home? I asked.
Bernardo seemed to think about that for a second, then shook his head. Neither do I.
He saved your life, Bernardo said.
I know. We went to the elevator. The elevator doors opened and Lieutenant Marks was standing there.
Where the fuck do you think you're going?
Marks, I think that Professor Dallas is in danger.